I am here now with Lois Rudnick. She is a new board member for here at KSFR, and I'd like to welcome you.
Thank you very much, Mary Fallett. I'm thrilled to be a new board member.
And it's great to have you. We've had you on the air a few times talking about your work as an art historian, as a cultural historian, as an immigration historian, and you bring so much wealth of knowledge to KSFR and energy to KSFR. It's the KSFR Fun Drive right now, as people who have been listening might know, and it's the time where we actually ask you to go to your telephone and make a call. The number is 428-1393, 428-1393, and to support the station, and we're calling on old donors and new, especially new, people who have not called KSFR before to make a contribution, and we know there's a couple of you out there. Why don't you give us a call right now, particularly if you like this show, if you like the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, if you like this station, 428-1393. Lois, why did you decide to join KSFR?
Primarily because of how much I love this show, the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Aww.
I moved here 2.5 years ago, even though I'd been coming for 38 years doing research here. And one of the things I think that's hard when you're a newcomer, even if you have friends here and know the area somewhat, is figuring out how to get connected to what's really exciting and interesting and significant in the way of social movements, art, cultural events, volunteer work, how to get connected to things that aren't already in your realm of knowledge. And for me, KSFR is like a university without walls. It's like continuing education for free. You get, especially for me on your show, the knowledge, the local knowledge, regional, national, international, global knowledge on the economy, on immigration, your interviews with authors writing about every subject under the sun. I've never heard interviews as in-depth and knowledgeable as yours, Mary Charlotte. You have such respect for the authors you speak with and the people you speak with. You genuinely read their work. You come up with questions that create the kind of dialogue that one expects in a really good classroom without ever speaking down to anybody. Everyone is invited into this conversation by the way that you engage in questions with the people you interview. So, because I can't pay attention to you at 8 o'clock in the morning, usually, I save you up, and
I listen
to your podcast.
Yay.
Like, every other week, I sit for, like, 3 hours, and I have this marvelous university education, you know, extra university education, postdoctoral work, which is a marvel of diversity in terms of topics. 428-1393. If you have never donated, donate. Our goal today is to raise at least $1,000.
Yes, during this show, $1,000. And we have a bunch of people calling, and we're very happy about that. And we have a goal for this fund drive of $70,000. And so that's what we need to raise. And, you know, I have been telling my friends and acquaintances, and people who've been on the show before, and just everybody I run into, it doesn't matter whether you give $5 or $10. It really doesn't.
Right.
What we like is to get the phones ringing madly, to get the people in the Fun Drive phone room going completely bananas with all the telephone calls that come in. And you know what? If you've got $10 to give, great. If you've got $10 a month to give, that's great too. It's nice because then you are a regular donor and you don't even have to listen during the fund drives, although you can if you want. And in fact, we're going to have, in just a minute, an interview that I recorded yesterday with a young woman named Elizabeth Klein, who's written this book called Overdressed. And when I first saw, I got an email about that book and I thought, oh God, a fashion book. But this is actually about well, you'll hear, but it's about what the fashion industry is doing to the planet. I think it's very interesting. So we're going to hear her in just a second. But please call 428-1393. We're looking for $1,000 by the end of this hour. We think we can get there, especially if you call. 428-1393. Let's go now to Elizabeth Klein. I'd like now to welcome journalist Elizabeth Klein. She's author of the new book, Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
So in your book, you compare fashion to food. There's fast food, which isn't very good for you, and everybody knows it. But there's also fast fashion, whose harm is a lot less visible, especially if we haven't read your book. How have our clothing buying and consumption patterns changed in the last few generations?
Well, I would say that much like the food industry, we're buying clothes from a very consolidated, very corporate market now. We buy clothes from a very narrow number of chains. But what we've also seen is the rise of fast fashion, where retailers are actually putting out new trends as cheaply and quickly as possible in an attempt to lure consumers back into stores over and over again. So clothing has gone from something that used to be, you know, a very intentional buy where you'd have to save up for it and you'd take care of it, to where we treat it as if it's essentially disposable.
And there are so many consequences to that, which we'll talk about in a moment.
Right.
How much do we as a nation consume in clothing each year? How big a piece of our economy is clothing?
The numbers are pretty staggering. Some of the more recent figures of what we're consuming, it puts the numbers at 68 garments and 8 pairs of shoes a year. So that's 20.5 billion garments in total. And the clothing industry is one of the largest consumer sectors, and we spend our spending on it, I think, outpaces our spending on even cars. So we're spending, it's a huge, huge part of the economy, and how we structure it and the way it operates has huge ramifications through all aspects of society, and of course, impacts our personal lives and our everyday lives as well.
When you talk about 68 garments, are you talking about men and women both?
Well, those are averages. So that's taking the total consumption per year and breaking it down on a per capita basis. Men and women have different buying habits, of course, and I think that the fast fashion phenomenon has been driven by women, and they're definitely buying more often than men are, for sure.
And definitely, I think, feed into a kind of, and you describe this in some of the characters that you've talked to in your book, a kind of addiction pattern.
Yeah, I think that I interviewed these haulers in the book, which are these women who go out and buy a lot of clothes at like Forever 21 and H&M and even at Target and Walmart, and then they make these videos and show off their purchases. And I think that that's certainly become a big part of our society. And it's not just teenagers. We all brag about getting deals now, especially on clothing. What person doesn't come home and say, you know, I got 60% off, or I got three tank tops for the price of one, or something like that. It's just a part of our culture now. And I mean, even Michelle Obama, for example, when she wears Target, when she wears something cheap, people just love her for it.
Now, your own process and participation in this whole clothing phenomenon is something that you are very honest about in the book. You realize that you owned hundreds and hundreds of pieces of clothing, many of which were poorly made and basically disposable. You piled them up in mountains in your living room floor. Did you do that when you started writing this book?
Yeah. And I think what was so shocking about it is that even though I owned more than 350 pieces of clothing, which sounds extreme, it's actually very typical. That would be what the average American would accumulate in a 5-year period. So, you know, over the course of a lifetime, just imagine the damage that we're all going to do if we continue to shop this way. But yeah, I wrote the book. The book was started just based on me noticing this path that I'd gone down, where I was in this cycle of buying and tossing clothes, or buying and just accumulating clothes and not wearing them. They would just sit in my closet, which is another thing that that a lot of people have gotten into. You buy clothes because they're cheap and you get a good deal, and then it just sits in your closet and goes unworn.
To what extent are our clothes made in the U.S. versus overseas, and how has that changed in recent decades?
Well, it's changed a lot. The garment and textile trades have been two of the fastest dying industries of the last 10 years. They're some of the most outsourced industries. We now make 2% of our clothing in the United States, 1% of our footwear. And in 1990, we still made about half here. And going back to the 1960s, we made almost all of it here. So the change has been dramatic. And especially starting in the around the 1990s with trade liberalization, it really couldn't move overseas fast enough. It was just, it practically happened overnight. It was so fast.
How did that work exactly with trade liberalization? Why did that so quickly push jobs overseas?
Well, without going into too much detail, and I do talk about this in the book a lot because I think it's important for people to understand, but there used to be regulations or quotas in place on how many garments we could import from developing countries. And, there were certain things like NAFTA, for example, in the mid-90s were the beginning of it. But when this quota system was lifted in 2005, basically there were no protections of the U.S.-based apparel industry. So that's when you really started seeing all of it going to places like China, which has a very sophisticated network of factories.
My grandparents came from Sicily. They settled in New York. They worked in the garment industry, and they ended up owning a pants stitching shop, and they lived a kind of textbook American dream story. They owned a duplex in Queens. They had a decent life. They went back to Sicily. They sent their kids to college, at least one of them. And that story, it seems like it's not even possible anymore. Has that kind of thing disappeared?
That was part of the reason why I was so interested in writing about what's happened, especially to the New York garment industry, just because it used to be the heart and soul of the American garment manufacturing system. And a lot of people maybe their knee-jerk reaction would be to say, well, does it matter that we don't have a garment industry here because they're such low-paying jobs? But the reality is that the people who had those jobs in many cases have been pushed into lower paying work and less stable work. And so what was for a very long time, like which is what you're describing, these industries were a pathway for people at the bottom of the economic ladder to work their way into the American society and to achieve the middle class dream. And those lifelines or those rungs on the ladder are not there anymore. And that's not just true of garment manufacturing. It's true of a lot of manufacturing sectors. And, I just think that you're absolutely right. Those jobs were a way into the middle class, and they no longer exist anymore. And it's a real problem.
We're talking to journalist Elizabeth Klein about her book, Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. And I'm sitting here in the Baking Company with Lois Rudnick, and we are offering this book to anybody who calls. I think we've got 5 copies of it. Maybe we've got a few more, but I know we have 5 copies of this book. And for a contribution of $60 to KSFR, you can get a copy of that book. If you decide you want to make a contribution, a monthly contribution of, let's say, $10 a month, you can also get a copy of the book, which would be lovely, and then you will be a KSFR donor and sustainer. Mary Lynn is in the control room, and she's got some thank yous.
I do indeed, especially for you, mwah, Mary Charlotte.
Mwah.
Barbara Cohen.
Thank you.
And then thanks to, we can only thank Carol Horowitz.
Who loves you,
but she says she needs to be able to vote for chickens in the dogs and cats vote.
We're not doing dogs and cats this phone drive. I know. She is a chicken and egg person, which is a beautiful thing.
And then Baron Woolman.
Oh, thank you.
Bev Kennedy Jones.
Oh, thank you.
And Sally Blakemore.
Yay, everybody.
And then a special thanks from Stephen to Lois on their anniversary. And Lois, I'm not sure I'm allowed to say how many years.
47.
Oh, boy.
You've been married for 47 years.
Yes. And we're heading toward having our own room at the Smithsonian History Museum, if we can make it to 60 or 70.
Really?
Yes.
4281393. If nothing else, make a contribution to congratulate somebody on a long, happy, and successful marriage, which is sometimes a rare thing in this
world. Exactly. And if you think about it, I couldn't imagine a better interview for a fundraising campaign, since instead of going out and buying the pair of shoes and the dress that you don't need, you can donate $30, $50, $100 to KSFR and expand your intellectual, emotional, and moral lives tremendously.
4281393. That is a really good point. Thank you for saying that. It's true. There is something, I mean, you know, like any other gal, I like having a nice pair of shoes. I like having a new pair of shoes. I like having some clothes that I feel that I look good in and above all I'm comfortable in. And sometimes that combination is a little hard to find.
Mm-hmm.
But I do not enjoy the experience of shopping. And one of the things that is really interesting to me about this book and this interview is she goes in to some extent to the culture of shopping and to the extent to which people are being marketed, particularly women, to enter into a cycle of regular shopping. So instead of shopping, I mean, when I was a kid, we really shopped twice a year.
We shopped
in the spring and we shopped in the fall, mm-hmm, for clothing. And it was mainly because I was growing out of the ones from the last season. And that was it. And a lot of it was through catalogs. We rarely went to the mall or anything even like that. And the regularity with which people shop, this sort of daily, weekly, 4, 6, 8 times a month thing, is something which is, I guess, good for the bottom line of the clothing manufacturers. But when you think about what it does to your mind and your pocketbook, you should call 4281393.
Absolutely.
428-1393 is the number for the KSFR Fund Drive. Please call now. I think the phones are ringing, so let's get them ringing more. We want to get $1,000 this hour, and we want to get $70,000 for the Fund Drive.
Excellent. And think not only about how your money is going to a much better cause if you contribute to KSFR at 428-1393, but the fact that even if you buy U.S.-made clothing, you need to know who it's made by. You need to think about the exploitation of child labor and women's labor in particular, since some of the most exploitative industries in the world today are industries that make fashions for, industries that make clothing for the fashion industry.
428-1393. KSFR is an American station, and you know that it's homemade.
And it's independent
public
radio.
And we're open to people of all nations of the world and
exactly.
Ideas from all over the world. But this is truly local, independent production.
Absolutely.
428-1393. In addition to all the other perks you get from contributing to KSFR, the perk of having the station in the first place, the perk of the book, if you would like that. And there is also another one, which is that everybody who donates during the drive is entered into a drawing for a festival pass to the New Mexico Jazz Festival's Lenzik shows. Regina Carter, Alan Toussaint, and the Dirty Dozen Brass Band, NEA Jazz Master Sheila Jordan and Diane Reeves, and John Hendricks and Kirk Elling. And that is an unbelievable lineup. So you could be the winner of that, too. 428-1393.
Help us reach $1,000, and we will have a chair that will just blow your minds.
Excellent.
Cheer. Sorry, that's my Boston accent. C-H-E-E-R.
Oh,
chair.
Cheer.
Cheer.
Cheer. Let's go back to Elizabeth Klein, and please get those phones ringing like crazy. 428-1393. We'll be back in a little bit. Let's talk for a moment about China. You visited China. You visited factories in China. What does garment manufacturing look like there? What's it like for the workers? What's it like for the environment?
Well, I think that what was probably most surprising about my trip there, I mean, there were so many things that kind of blew my mind, and I describe them in detail in the book, but one thing that I just wasn't expecting was that a lot of the factory workers there are starting to get a taste for fashion. So, you know, they don't make a lot of money, but they're spending, a lot of them are young girls, and they're spending their money on trendy tops and stretch jeans. And, you know, the American consumer lifestyle is spreading to China is what I saw. And that's going to have huge ramifications for sustainability in the fashion industry. We're already seeing some of those problems, and they're just going to get worse as fast fashion and cheap disposable fashion spreads to China, which is already happening. And in terms of the environmental problems, you know, when the textile and garment trades were in the U.S., they were fairly regulated in terms of environmental impact. And now you see the textile industry in countries like China where there are very few environmental regulations. So basically when we get a good price on a, you know, a cheap import, what we're not paying for is the environmental regulations that should be in place. So that's another reason why we get such a good deal. And, you know, the price tag should reflect the environmental implications, and it just doesn't.
It's almost exactly like the problem of food. So you get cheap junk food or cheap fast food, you know, in a fast food restaurant, and it doesn't reflect the cost of diabetes and heart disease and all the things that are caused down the line. It's like the same pattern.
I know, and because the industry is spread out all over the world, it's even harder for consumers to connect with those problems because they're not seeing them. You know, you're not waking up every day and seeing the, like, horrible pollution that I saw in southern China in these manufacturing cities. So it's very easy to be disconnected from where your how your clothes are being made. And but I do think that there's frustration from consumers, and consumers are very getting to a place where they're very wary of how this whole system is working. Because I mean, the prices are just shockingly low. You know, it's not impossible to walk into a store like H&M and get like a fully formed garment for $5. And I think we all are sort of intuit that there's something wrong there, that the price doesn't reflect the whole story.
So where are those low prices coming from? Where are the savings coming from? You talk about what clothing used to cost 50 and 100 years ago in terms of real dollars, and an article of clothing was really expensive as a percentage of income, and as you say, something you have to save up for. I mean, specifically, why is it so much less now?
Well, there are two components to it, I would say. One is that the quality and the craftsmanship of clothing, mass market clothing, is really at an all-time low. And it's not just the materials. Well, okay, it is partly the materials. We've seen the use of polyester skyrocket over the last 15 years. That's really been the biggest growth in terms of what fibers are being used in clothes. And then the clothes that we're wearing are very simple compared to what we would have worn, say, in the 50s and 60s, when you saw these really beautifully tailored clothes. And if you were wearing a dress or a suit, it would be fully lined. Everything, all of the trim, the buttons, would be well made. Every detail of the garment had some thought put into it, and we're not really seeing that now. Now clothing is engineered to be disposable. But the other aspect of it is that these retailers produce clothing at an incredibly high volume. So they operate like any other discounter, like a Walmart or something, where by selling millions upon millions of garments per year, they can afford to put the lowest markup possible on the clothing and pass the savings onto the consumer that way.
What happens to clothing once, I mean, okay, you've got all these things. It turns out you didn't really wear most of them. We all buy clothes that we ended up not wearing.
Yeah.
You give them to the Salvation Army, or you give them to Goodwill or whatever. What happens to them then?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of Americans are still just throwing clothes away. We're throwing away 68 pounds of textiles a year, and that should not be happening, because clothing is almost 100% recyclable. Even if it can't continue on as clothing, it can be reprocessed into fiber for like car insulation, or it can be turned into wiping rags. What happens when you donate your clothes to Salvation Army is that a small fraction of them actually are sold in the retail stores, but we're simply consuming and donating so much clothing that the majority is passed on to textile recyclers. And there's nothing wrong with that process. It's just that consumers are very disconnected with the waste that they're creating, and that's why I describe what happens in the book in detail about that whole system. Because I think that people still imagine that there's always some person out there that's in need of every cast off, but really there's this very elaborate recycling system that's set up to handle the waste.
So the clothes that you or I don't want. We give them the Salvation Army. Most of it doesn't end up on the backs of your neighbors. It ends up as you say, the lining of car seats or rags, or some of it ends up in Africa. Tell us that story.
Most of it, so the stuff that is actually continues on to a textile recycler, the majority is then sold as secondhand clothing in Africa. And then another, I think maybe 20% is turned into fiber for car insulation, then maybe another third is used for wiping rags. But yeah, and I think that this is going back to the 1950s. Most of our secondhand clothing has been sold in a secondhand market overseas just because there's simply so much of it. And there's nothing, again, there is nothing inherently wrong with that. It's just that it's another example of how disconnected consumers are from how much they're buying and in turn how much they're throwing away. Most people have no idea that whole system even exists. They do, as you said earlier, they imagine that those clothes are going to some neighbor in need, which is not the case.
As you describe it, the phenomenon of fashion reflects our society in very specific ways and in a lot of ways. And one of them is that you see high-end and low-end clothing and not much in the middle, just as we're experiencing the disappearance of the middle class.
Yes.
So what's that about with clothing? Is there's just no market for well-made, mid-level, mid-market clothes?
Well, it's sort of a feedback loop going to what we were talking about earlier in the conversation. I mean, we have seen the decline of the middle class, so there are arguably fewer consumers out there who can afford better-made clothes. But I don't think that's the whole picture. Clothing used to be something that, nice clothing that is something that we used to aspire to own. People wanted to own the best thing they could for their money. And now you're seeing kind of a complete reversal with clothing where people want to pay either as little as they can or they want to show off and express their status through owning designer and luxury clothing. And there isn't a lot of demand in the middle for things that are just rationally priced and well made. And I think part of that is because our entire garment industry is overseas. People don't sew anymore, and people are a lot less educated about clothes. And it's the parallel there is again there with food, where, you know, fast food was sort of, I would say, in style for a couple decades. It was completely acceptable. And then we got to a place where people said, you know what, this is really unsatisfying. And they started going back to home cooking and getting into you know, nutrition and eating healthy because people miss that connection. And I think that's what's going to have to happen with the fashion industry as well.
We're talking to Elizabeth Klein about her book, Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. And we have 4 copies of the book left. We are well on our way to our $1,000 goal for this hour, but we still need the phones to ring like mad. 428-1393. And you can get a copy of this book. It's cool. It's readable. It's fun.
It sounds great. I would like to make a plug here for the great consignment stores in Santa Fe and El Dorado where I live. I buy all my clothes that I don't buy in Frugal Fanny's in Boston when I go home.
Frugal Fanny's.
Yes, a fabulous fashion warehouse that has some good quality clothing at the consignment stores in Santa Fe. And these are often high quality, high end clothing that I could not afford to buy at full price.
It's true. And we'll be talking about that with Elizabeth in the next segment. And there's also, I mean, one of the things that I learned from reading this book is that they, when you bring clothes to, like in New York City, she went to where they sort the clothes at the Salvation Army. And there are people sitting at these benches going through tens of thousands of garments per day.
Wow.
And only 10% of them even get onto the shelves, which means that although those places have a reputation for having, you know, that's everybody's secondhand junk, it's actually the very best of the secondhand stuff. And so that's a good place to buy clothes, too. 428-1393 is the number. There are 4 books left if you want to get a copy of Overdressed by Elizabeth Klein. And Mary Lynn, do we have any thank yous?
Plenty of thank yous.
Yay.
We have Janet Davidson on behalf of New Mexico Women in Film.
Thank Thank you. They had a big event this weekend. I'm so glad. Thank you.
And a big thank you to you, Mary Charlotte, for the insightful stories you give from Billy Blair.
Oh, thank you, Billy.
Anne Hillerman.
Yay.
Thanks,
Shelley,
Anne.
Yeah, Shelley Robinson.
Thank you.
Richard Olson.
Yay.
And then, Mary Charlotte, you're considered, you know, Santa Fe's living treasure.
Uh-oh.
From...
I'm not 70
by
yet.
Or from your fairy dog son.
My I have been made the godmother of a little dog. It's the cutest thing. It's really a beautiful dog named Tino, which is short for Valentino. And if dog forbid anything happens to Valentino's mother, it is my duty to take over the well-being of this dog. Thank you so much. Thanks to all of you. And we're, like I said, we're getting close to our $1,000 goal for this hour. And we've got people in the baking company coming up and seeing what's going on here, because it's the fun drive. So 428-1393.
And I'd like to also have people who are concerned about how they can shop both for good clothing and responsibly, ethically, think about looking at such books as Shopping for a Better World. There are all kinds of wonderful websites like globalexchange.org/frontsweatfree/link, so you can find out what kinds of manufacturers are selling clothes that don't exploit women and children and pay them wages that are unfit and give them working conditions that are unfit for them, and hours of work that are exploitative and destructive of their health and well-being.
That is really, really important.
Yes.
And it's tricky. And again, I think we'll talk with Elizabeth about this in the next segment, but there is something to be said for... I mean, it's great to find a bargain and all of that, but it turns out that a fair price isn't always the lowest price.
Exactly. Sometimes if you're factoring in the ethics, if you're factoring in the value of the labor of the person who is making the product, you know, one of the most powerful social activism movements of the 90s on college campuses was getting college campuses to fine students rising up and getting bookstores and universities to buy sweat-free uniforms for their sports teams.
Sweat-free sweatpants?
Sweat-free sweatpants, sweat-free T-shirts and sweatshirts and caps. And to disinvest in companies that exploited offshore child labor and women's labor.
Very interesting. It's very, very important stuff. And what you want to read one of those websites again?
http://www.http. I know. globalexchange.org/sweatfree/links.
You know what? Just Google sweat free. 428. 428-1393 is the number for the KSFR Fun Drive, and we want to thank all the people who've called so far. Lovely, wonderful, grateful thanks. And to those of you who haven't called yet and who are listening, please give a call. We're going to go back to Elizabeth Klein in just a moment, but this is the time to do it. And I think I want to make a plug again for people who have never called before. Lois, do you remember the first time you ever donated to public radio?
Yes, it's when I got a letter from you back in Boston. And I did not ever before donate to organizations in places where I did not live or national organizations that I was, you know, connected to. And I said, I've got to give money to this radio station because the work that Mary Charlotte does, and it was the only thing I knew about KSFR at the time, is so important.
You didn't donate to WGBH?
Oh, of course. Oh, yes. But I meant outside the state of Massachusetts.
Oh, okay.
Of course I did. Absolutely. It's a wonderful station.
It is a wonderful station. I remember that was actually the first time I made a donation, was to the public radio station in Boston. And I think I was 24 years old. And I listened to that thing day and night. I'd moved
it's
to a
great.
New place. I didn't have any friends. I didn't know what I was doing. And just was listening to a lot of radio. And finally they said, you know, this could be you. You should donate. They kept saying you, and I was like, me?
Yep. And I think that point you made, the point I made at the beginning and that you just reiterated, that this is a fabulous place to go to figure out what to do in Santa Fe.
Yeah.
You know, what organizations are doing the kind of work that you respect that you might want to volunteer for. what art events seem to be the most exciting. I've gone to many things that I heard about on your Friday show of, you know, what's happening in the arts over the next week that I might not have gone to, even though I'm a religious reader of Pasa Tiempo.
Right. Oh, very interesting. Yeah. There's a way in which radio is alive.
Yep.
In a way that even the best print journalist, it's just a different medium, but sometimes when you hear the voice of that person, of the artist or the musician
yes,
or whatever,
absolutely.
It makes you want to go. 428-1393. One of the phones is busy. The other phones are not busy. I don't want to get to where I'm taking that personally. 428-1393.
And as a newbie, I don't want to take it personally
That's
either.
That's right. So let's go back to Elizabeth Klein. Please remember, let's give the 800 number, the 866 number. This is a toll-free number. If you're out of area and you've got a landline, call 866-977-5737. That's 866-977-KSFR. 866-977-KSFR. And we're going to go back to Elizabeth Klein, and we'll be back in just a bit. This sort of dates me, but I learned to make clothes when I was in home ec in the 7th and 8th grades, and I was very good at it, and I saved a lot of money, and I made whatever I wanted to wear. And then I remember there was this day in the 1990s, I can't remember what year it was, but I bought this really nice sleeveless silk shirt for $10. It was a cobalt blue shirt. I wore the heck out of it for years, but I realized I can't make clothes for the price that I could. It actually was cost me more to make my own clothes than to buy them. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I mean, it's staggering considering that my labor was free in that calculation. I mean, just the patterns, the thread, the buttons and things like that added up to more than the price of an inexpensive silk shirt. So what is there a place for handmade clothes at this point?
Yeah, you bring up a lot of really good points. I mean, the reason why people have stopped sewing is because it was always something that people did to be thrifty. That was always a huge part of it, because it at some point was cheaper to make things yourself than it was to buy them in stores. In terms of whether or not sewing will make a huge comeback, I mean, it's doubtful, just because it's very time intensive, and you have to kind of have that creative flair. It's just kind of, it can be frustrating. It depends on your personality type is what I would say, whether or not it's frustrating or satisfying. But I think that I bring it up in the book, one, to just talk about how much things have changed in a generation or two in terms of how knowledge about clothing used to be passed down, and I think it was partly because more people knew how to sew. But that knowledge extended into knowing about fabrics and craftsmanship, and that made people better consumers, because then you could just walk into a store and flip a shirt inside out and know what you were looking at. And now it's a little bit harder today, because you don't have that knowledge that used to get passed down, and even knowledge that was spread in schools. I mean, I think that I did have, I had a home ec class, and that would have been in the, where I learned how to sew, and that would have been the early 90s. But yeah, I'm pretty sure that's not being taught in schools anymore.
You went through a change in what you considered a fair price, and this whole idea of what is a fair price for clothing, mm-hmm. It turns out it's not necessarily the lowest price.
Yeah, absolutely. What we're paying, when we pay very little money for clothing, it's, like I was saying earlier, it doesn't include the environmental toll that garment has taken, and it doesn't include a fair price for a fair wage for the person who's sewing it. And the book doesn't really get into sweatshops per se. I talk really more about how poverty wages are the norm in the garment industry now, and moving back into the 50s and 60s in the U.S., the garment industry was largely unionized. It was not a bad way to make a living. And so what we're seeing today is that it's almost universally a very low-paying job, garment work is, and that even the people who still do it in the U.S. are getting paid very little money. So yes, we get to buy cheap clothes because the environmental and labor issues are not reflected in the price tag, and that's why I say that cheap clothes are not fairly priced, and why, just from an ethical standpoint, we should be willing to pay more.
So how do you start learning to make good decisions about what's, for example, fair trade clothing, what is well-made clothing, what is clothing that's not contributing to the environmental problems?
I think the main thing is to be more mindful when you're approaching clothes. And what I mean by that is right now a lot of us are buying clothes on impulse. We maybe walk into a store on our way home from work and just buy something that we didn't really plan on buying. But if you're more strategic about your spending, so Americans spend $1,100 a year on average on clothes, let's say you want to stick to that. Well, if you sit down at the beginning of the month or the beginning of the year and you strategize about how you want to spend that money, you're going to end up buying things that you're happier with, just because you put thought into it. And from there, certainly people, if they're interested in it, can do research on ethical brands, independent designers, locally made brands. And I've actually started a list of some alternative brands on my blog, thegoodcloset.tumblr.com. But I think it's all about intentionality and just slowing down and thinking about what you're doing.
So it really is like slow food. It's like it's the slowing down in all these different areas of one's life, which I was thinking about you. I mean, you're a young woman in New York, mm-hmm. where fashion is a lot more important, if I dare say, than it is here in Santa Fe. Mm-hmm. And you still, I mean, do you have to kind of quote-unquote keep up with the trends?
Yeah, and I think that was probably one of the main reasons that set me on this path to figure out what was happening with fast fashion, because following trends, I remember a day when I found it enjoyable, and then it's just that it's gone too far. The rules change too quickly now. If you want to be in fashion, it's almost like the requirement today is that you have to shop on a daily or weekly basis. Like, that's how quickly things are changing. So I think that, you know, there's nothing inherently wrong with following trends. It's just that it's gotten to a point where it's quite maddening, and I think that it's frustrating for a lot of consumers to try and keep up, because you just end up back in the stores all the time, and then you're looking at what you were wearing just last year and, you know, being like, what was I thinking? What did I have on? And it's just because, you know, we've all kind of gotten sucked into shopping in this very trendy way.
And if you think about what that does to your mind, like, let's say you were using your shopping time for meditation practice or for walking outdoors or for having tea with a friend or something like that. I mean, it really is a choice of how you devote your attention in the limited time, which is called our lives.
I think about that all the time because, you know, I don't shop very much anymore. And I do so now, and I know that that's not something that everybody's going to take up, but it's just a really fun, really gratifying hobby for me. And maybe that's time that I would have spent in a store before, you know, and I think that that's a better, more satisfying way to spend an afternoon. And the other thing is, you know, I see a seamstress now, and I love having, you know, a relationship with someone in my community. That's not something that I ever had when I shopped in stores. I didn't know the people behind the cash register on the sales floor. It was always just a one-way interaction. I'm buying this garment and giving you money. I'm going to walk out and never see you again. And certainly, like, slow clothing it's all about reinvesting in your community, supporting local businesses, and also having a more involved, interactive relationship with the clothes that are in your wardrobe.
And which I have to say here, I don't know if you do this in New York, but me and various friends of mine have once or twice a year clothing swaps.
Yeah.
So we basically take everything we don't wear out of the closet, go to somebody's house, everybody puts it on the floor, and you rummage through it. And I have some of my nicest clothes from those things.
Yeah, I love that has really taken off in the last couple of years. I know that there are clothing swaps in pretty much every larger city in the U.S. now, and I just think it's fantastic. And I also see more like clothing rental websites springing up. You know, sites like Rent the Runway, and there's a vintage website in New York that I use sometimes. Yeah, I think, you know, people crave novelty in their wardrobe. That's totally human, and I think that clothing swaps and clothing rentals, and for me, it's vintage and secondhand clothes. Like, that's where I really let myself, like, I'll buy as much as I want in a secondhand store, because those are clothes that are already in the, they're already in the secondhand waste stream anyway, and they need a good home.
Elizabeth Klein is a journalist. She's author of the new book, Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
428-1393 is the number. I don't know if we have any copies of the book left, but I think we do. So if you want a copy of that book, give us a call. 428-1393. Make a contribution to KSFR. And Lois, hi.
Yes. Hi.
Lois Rudnick has been joining us this whole hour.
I was thinking as Elizabeth was talking that there, my daughter's involved in two other kinds of swaps, which are wonderful for recycling. One is toy swap, since American children probably have 1,000 times more toys than they need, and they tire of them even more quickly than women and men may tire of the fashions they wear. And the other is, and I don't know quite how this works, is a book exchange where she goes onto a site, lists the books that she has that she has read and wants to recycle, and lists the books that she wants to get, and she makes trades. And the only thing you pay for is the mailing of the book. Book rate, which is very cheap. It's great, so that these books get continuously circulated and not just thrown out. Of course, they can be donated to libraries too.
Right, and that's something that you can't do once you start reading your books on electronic devices.
Right.
But you'll never wear electronic clothes. Clothes are always going to be
we
physical.
Don't know that.
428-1393. We've got two books left. Let's get them both. We are so close. We're very close to our $1,000 mark. 428-1393, make a donation to KSFR. Make a donation if you've never donated before, or make a donation if you haven't donated in a while. Do we have any thank yous?
Yes, indeed.
Oh, goody.
Camille Flores.
Thank you.
And she especially thanks you for all the support to local writers.
Oh, good. Yay.
And Curlin from the Blue Lotus Integrative Health Services also
wonderful.
Contributed to this. So there we go.
Okay.
And there was some anonymi.
Some anonymi. We like the anonymi. One of the things, I always forget to say this, but if you want to donate but you don't want your name read on the air, that's completely fine. Or if you want to donate in the name of your dog.
Or cat. Let's not be doggist.
I am not doggist. I'm catist. 428-1393. What is it if you're against? Well, anyway, 428-1393 is the number, and we've got just about 4 minutes left to reach our $1,000 goal, and we're what, $100, $200 away from it right now, and so we are almost there. Maybe let's say we're $200. It's hard for me to update because I'm sitting in the cafe. But let's say we're $200 away. Four contributions of $50.
Fabulous.
Eight contributions of $25. Now get those phone volunteers going nuts, which we like. Or two contributions of $60, and then the rest, whatever you want, because then you can get those books. It'll be lovely to get all five of those books out the door and into your collective hands.
I think of a wonderful quote from a Pakistani activist that you had on last year, Ayesha Khan.
Yeah.
KSFR allowed her to raise money for, you know, terrible floods that had occurred in Pakistan.
That's
20
right.
million people underwater. And she said, with tears in her eyes and a throb in her voice, that public radio makes changes in the world. And I think that's really important to recognize, that it's not just an information conveyance place, which is, of course, is important in of itself, but it can, you know, make changes in the way the world works and help people who wouldn't be able to have that kind of help without the knowledge that they gain from people who are then supportive and donating to protect them or to make their lives better.
505-428-1393. I've been accused of speaking too quickly. 428 1393. And, you know, I'll tell you something about that, Aisha Khan and the Pakistani floods. We did a couple of interviews during that time, and it was such a great humanitarian and natural disaster. It was bigger than the tsunami, but what happened was we did this interview, and she sent the podcast all over the United States, right, and all over Pakistan. That podcast was heard by thousands of people, and it was instrumental in raising several $100,000.
Wow.
And
that's
that incredible. Went to buying seeds for the next harvest in Pakistan, and they had a bumper crop the next harvest.
Oh,
and
wow.
Part of that was due to this conversation that we had on sitting in the baking company.
And I remember she pointedly said that most of the Western media had not covered that story. So this was the way it got out, was right here in Santa Fe.
I would like to thank also Stuart Ashman, who called. Wonderful person who it was a great loss when he left Santa Fe, but he just called to make a contribution to KSFR. Thank you so much. 428-1393, we've got 1 minute left. We've got 1 minute and 1 second, now 1 minute, now 59. And we want one or two more calls. I think we will have gotten to our $1,000 mark.
Oh, help us do it so you can hear our wonderful cry of joy.
Yes.
Before the program is over.
Our wonderful cry of joy. Should we give them a preview?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Huzzah!
Wow, you just broke the microphone. 428-1393. And she won't, if you call, she won't say huzzah again.
Thanks a lot, Mary Charlotte.
And it's just about time to go, but we want to thank you all for contributing to KSFR, for listening to KSFR. This is the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, and we're streaming at KSFR.org, where you can hear the show, where you can also donate. We're podcasting, and we made it! We made it.
Yay!
10
Eureka!
Seconds left. Thank you, everybody. And please continue listening to this lovely station, and we will see you tomorrow.
Thanks. Ciao.